This episode is sponsored by JDAQA Software Testing, your scalable solution for manual, automated, security, and performance testing. Check us out at JDAQA.com. And with that, let's get on with the show.
This is The First Customer, hosted by Jay Agner.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the First Customer Podcast. Today, I am lucky enough to be joined by Lamis Butt. She is the Senior VP of Partnerships at Zuvu. I think I got all that right. Did I get that right?
You did.
That was a mouthful. How are you?
I'm all right. Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's exciting.
Coming live from a small village outside of London, which we talked a little bit about. As an uncultured American, my geography is not great, but I do know where London is. So we had a fun conversation around that. So a little bit of a different guest today. I think this is very cool. You get to speak to a little bit of a different perspective, maybe than some of our normal guests, but I think you got some really relevant experience and you've been a founder, so you kind of know that role. Where did you grow up and did that, you know, have any impact on any of your entrepreneurial spirit along the way?
It's a good question. I grew up in East London. So obviously in the UK, in London, but it was the east of London. And anybody that is familiar with London knows that the east side of it isn't the most pleasant side. And so I'd say that my upbringing was, you know, it was a humble upbringing. And I wasn't, you know, born into money. But I actually think that paved the way for a lot of the hunger and the ambition that I had at a very young age. And so I found myself just always wanting more in any situation, whether that was school, whether that was kind of work experience. I just wasn't prepared to kind of take the normal path. And so I was always trying to think outside of the box and come up with creative ways of doing things, whether, you know, securing job interviews through CVs, created like newspapers and wrapping them up as Christmas gifts and sending them to people. It was just kind of built in me to do things differently. And just to say, yeah, I wasn't a kid that played with Barbie dolls. Not that there's anything wrong with Barbie, but I was a Lego builder. That was kind of what my parents gave me. And so I think the genesis was always building things.
Interesting. What is My Mannequin? I want to hear about this thing you founded. What was it? What is it? How'd you come to it?
So My Mannequin was actually born out of my university days. I openly and honestly went to university, studied a law degree for the first year and dropped out. It just wasn't for me, you know, and again, I think that being a young Southeast Asian girl, my parents wanted me to follow the path of least resistance, a safe path. But as soon as I'd done my first year, I just knew that I wasn't going to last being in that environment in the way that it felt quite restrictive. It wasn't creative. It didn't allow me to think outside the box. The law doesn't. So I realized, you know, that I wanted to set up a business, and that business manifested itself as a personal shopping business. So at university, I set up a blog and I actually got some interest from people saying, hey, do you do this as a service? And so I was earning, you know, back then it was like £1,000 per day to take people on these personal shopping sessions where I'd curate outfits for them and mix and match and create a lookbook. And I realized, God, you know, this is a problem, you know, that people had, because my audience, my customers were typically men. And it was men in the age range of about 27 to about 40. And they all had slightly different problems. But overall, the problems were that they wanted to feel seen and heard by women. And so maybe some were early in their kind of relationship game, and maybe some were later, maybe divorced and back on the market. But they all wanted to find themselves again. And so they felt that kind of getting their confidence back through fashion was a way to do it. And so I recognized that the problem existed not just in Kingston, in outside of London where I went to university, but this was a global problem. And so my head quickly went to, how can I scale this small business into something larger? And so My Mannequin was born, which was an app that you would come to, and it would ask you a series of questions about your lifestyle, brands that you like, your budget, and it would aggregate an outfit for you from all of the brands that you said you liked, and you could then purchase from within the app.
Wow. And what happened to that?
So long story short, the app itself, we got seed funding for it, which was incredible. Had, you know, tons of mentorship and all of those things. I made a ton of mistakes. I was in my early 20s. And after a few big failures. You know, some were my fault, some were external parties. The company failed, and it was probably the biggest to this day failure that I've had, but it taught me so, so much. But it did take me about a year to come back from that. And I was, 22 at the time.
Yeah, I was going to ask how long it took to recover, because that's a big roller coaster to kind of come over the top of and come back down, especially at that age. That's a lot to process, I would imagine.
It was.
Yeah. So did you kind of recalibrate after that and say, I want to go work and do something different? I want to work for somebody else and make the business stuff somebody else's problems? What was kind of the actual thought process there when you stepped back into the ring?
The truth was, back then, you know, I was 22. I had a degree in politics. I did drop out of law, but I pivoted and did a politics degree while I was building the business. And then when it tanked, I took about 6 months just to be with myself and kind of get myself back to a place of being able to wake up every day and, you know, try to see past it, because it was heavy. But I just decided I needed to pay the bills. And so paying the bills meant just getting a job. And at that stage, back then, it was, okay, let me go to a recruiter and let me just try and get any job that I can right now. And I got a job as a receptionist at a, you know who Mercedes-Benz are, right? The car.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. So I got a job as a receptionist at a Mercedes-Benz car dealership. And I just remember that day answering that phone, you know, hello, it's Lamise Butt from Mercedes-Benz. How can I redirect your call? It was brutal, like brutal. And I don't think that feeling will ever leave me, but what it did do, it was like fuel for my fire. And so kind of sitting in that moment, I just realized that I was in a position. Yes, I was in a Mercedes-Benz local dealership, but how can I use this position where I am right now to navigate something different? Very quickly, I would say within the space of 8 months, I was able to navigate to managing operations at a new branch that opened just through the network that I was building in and around the dealership. I was adding value in a ton of places. They were running things inefficiently. So I just made some suggestions for how they should be doing it differently. And it was picked up. And I remember getting called into the office one day and just said, we've got an opportunity for you. You'd have to essentially move branches, but would you be interested in running operations at this place? And I was like, hell yeah, like absolutely. Right. So yeah. Moved, did that. And then within another year, I managed to navigate myself to Mercedes-Benz headquarters, which was their, you know, big head office, and then was running projects for Europe for Mercedes-Benz and living out of a suitcase for a few years.
Wow. I want to clarify. I have heard, obviously, of Mercedes. I have never owned one. I have not been fortunate to own a Mercedes, but I have certainly heard of it. So let's fast forward. What is it that you do today for Zuvu? Like, I mean, it's a pretty lofty title, senior VP, global partnerships and all sorts of, you know, fancy keywords and stuff that I'm sure you get hit up with lots of spam about as a SVP. What do you do on a day-to-day basis today?
So my job day-to-day is, how do we take the company that we have right now and scale it? So, you know, it's about growth and scalable growth, and that's not going to happen kind of one-to-one. It's about one-to-many. So we want to develop a series of partnerships, be that strategic partnerships, technology partnerships, with the right people that kind of fit our ICP, so our ideal customer profile. And we want to really help their organizations serve their customers by enabling them with our technology, Zuvu.
So this is where I think it becomes extremely relevant to this podcast. Like I said, you know, typically we have founders on and it's more about their story and their first customer. But now we're at the point where we can talk about things that are applicable to everybody, right? So if somebody has a B2B SaaS company or a B2C company or whatever, just talk in general terms about that one-to-many relationship that partnerships enables you, because we've done that in my company and I kind of stumbled into that as just the CEO figuring things out as I went through and just sending people emails and calling people and saying, hey man, you guys have this tool that like potential customers of ours would use. I would love to help, you know, help those customers use your tool. And absolutely. And that's become, you know, just over the years has grown into this portfolio of pretty impressive partnerships with these leading tool companies in the industry. So talk a little bit about, you know, partnerships in general. What does the one to many mean? And like, how would somebody apply that to their business if they're just trying to kind of get out of that, you know, hunt and peck, you know, kind of lead prospecting thing? Like, how do they use partnerships instead?
So I think, you know, the core and the foundation is obviously always to understand and know your customer deeply. So if you know who your customer is and you know who you're serving, it's much easier to go and find partners that align to your values and your customers. And the beauty is that once you understand those customers, it means that you understand their pain. And once you understand the pain, you can then kind of, you know, see from a partnership perspective, do those customers have that pain as well? Because you're not only, because what you don't want to be doing, and I've seen this happen with many organizations, and I've also been a part of some of the largest organizations that do this, but it leads to just inefficiency, poor productivity, because what you do is it's a numbers game about partnerships and not value. So you find people, you know, building spreadsheets of, you know, all of the partner referral agreements that they've sent out, and they're so excited because they've got 200 partnerships, but they've actually turned around no revenue because of it. Whereas actually, when you look at the organizations that have focused and got maybe 2 to 3 partnerships that are highly focused, that really solve a problem for their customers, actually, you'll see a real return and scalability through those channels. So I think the one-to-one approach definitely is good for the early stage businesses. Really kind of own your craft, your mission, and get to know the customer. But the moment that you feel that actually you've got a specific set of use cases, you're solving real problems, now you can go and actually, it's a different angle. It's just essentially pivoting slightly and looking at the organizations that also have those, your customers as their customers, and be able to solve their problems, whether that's what we call kind of in an attach motion. So whether you're selling both products together, or you might be selling it completely alone and you're just adding value because, you know, for example, like you said, it's just a tool provider.
The one thing that's a great point. It's the high value. I mean, there has to be value in the partnerships. There's no, like, having a list of 200 partners and affiliate links, and it doesn't matter if they're not converting, who cares?
Yeah.
But one of the things I did learn along the way was I had lunch with this guy. It was another tools company. It was a little bit bigger one. And I was talking to him. He's more of a sales guy. And it just struck me that, like, his lack of interest in a partnership was because I wasn't providing value to him. Right. Yeah. And it's very easy to, like, try to get value for you out of a partnership and try to, like, kind of bring these partners in and be like, well, look, it'd be really great. But how do you provide that value? How do you make sure you're providing that? Are you pitching value at these partnership companies and you're saying, like, this is what we're going to be able to get you? Because even getting those partnerships is tough sometimes. It's got to be a two-way street. Money's got to be flowing both ways, or, like, nobody's going to make the first move, right? So, like, how are you going out and kind of attacking these partnerships in a way that's like, we're going to provide you this value? Is it kind of a standard sales pitch, but tweak for aiming at partners that you're like, look, these are other partners that we work with, and this is the revenue we've been able to give them, and this is how we could work together? Is that how you go about it?
You know, I actually really like to tweak it based on the profile of person that I'm speaking to. So, you know, I'm sure a lot of your audience will be familiar with that concept of being a chameleon, especially, you know, in the entrepreneurial, the founder space. We have to tailor our narrative to who we're speaking to ensure that it lands with that specific individual. So if I'm speaking to a salesperson at that organization, let's just say it's a VP of sales or their head of sales, and I want to be able to build a partnership with this person, I'm talking dollar signs. I'm talking what you are going to see at the end of this year by partnering with me. That's what we're talking about. If I'm talking to a solutions person, or if I'm talking to perhaps even leadership, I'm actually not so much focused on the revenue. I'm actually focused on what they care about, which is solving a real problem for their customer, because they know if I'm solving the real problem for their customer, the coin comes. And so it's just about knowing that at any level, I would create maybe 2 to 3 different pitches, and they have to be tailored based on the persona of the person that you're speaking to.
That's great. I love that. How are you procuring your targets to go after for partnerships?
So for at the moment, we are highly focused on kind of a couple of partnerships, one of them being SAP. So SAP is our most strategic partner, and it's because ultimately across their portfolio, they have 400,000 customers. And so quite honestly, there's enough for us to chew on probably for the next few years, if, you know, even if we wanted to. But we're solving very real problems for their B2B customer base and B2C. I mean, Zuvu's customer base is split 70% B2C, 30% B2B. But that's because historically, we have built our business working with Dyson, Bosch, Microsoft, really focused B2C brands. However, what we're seeing in today's market is we're about to go through a real revolution in the B2B space, because that concept of future-proofing organizations, the way that they were historically running, having to call a salesperson and be on the phone for 90 minutes to build a quote because the products are so complex that it's a 2,000-page catalog to go through all of the configurations, like that can't happen anymore. You know, the millennials, the Gen Zs that are going to be taking over these roles in the next, you know, 5 years, they won't be dealing with that level of process. And so we have to think about how we digitize that sales process for the B2B world. And so Zuvu and SAP, it's almost just like a match made in heaven right now to help these organizations think about their next 5 to 10 years.
Even the letters AI make my skin crawl a little bit just from the complete oversaturation of the term these days. But does it have any specific use cases in partnerships?
AI?
Partnerships seem to be such a human thing. And there's a lot of nuance and context required. Yeah. I mean, is there any opportunity? Is there anything people are doing with it now? Like, how does it fit in that space?
So, you know, it's interesting because I think AI, you know, there's obviously a ton of hype right now. And obviously generative AI and ChatGPT. And I feel like I was giving a keynote a few weeks back and it was all about generative AI. And the question I kept getting asked was, you know, how come, you know, what's the future going to be like with generative AI? And it was almost like very vague questions. And this was coming from media. And I get it because they want to know how to report it back to their audience, back to the market. And the one answer that I kept giving back was, you have to think about it, you know, from your customer's perspective. So what I mean by that is applied AI works, but you can only apply the AI if you know the problem that you're solving. And so from a Zuvu perspective, for example, we're solving problems by helping our customers find the right products for their needs. So let's just say Bosch, right? My washing machine broke and I have no idea. I'm not an expert with drum sizes and washing machines and all the things that you need to know, but I just know I need a good washing machine. I also don't have time to go to the local, you know, retailer to be able to have that conversation with a sales rep. So I want to go online and I want to have that same experience that I would have with an experienced sales rep, but have it online. So ask me, how many kids do I have? What's my family size? You know, how many washes do I do a week? Do I want to dry the clothes? What type of clothes am I doing? Ask me human questions and get me to the product for my needs. And so we're solving real problems with our platform. That said, I do believe that there is always going to be an alliance between human beings and AI, because I think there always has to be that context that's applied to it, especially right now. You know, I think it's hard to say in 5 to 10 years what it's going to look like because things are moving so fast. And I don't think anyone at this stage could probably say what it's going to look like because of how fast it's moving. But what I would say is that as long as you can apply it to a problem, we're gonna stay on a good path.
Yeah, I think the C word, context, I think is the biggest, it's the biggest thing that humans offer to the equation, right? And I get the same question a lot about, and we do software quality assurance. I get the same question, is AI going to take over? And I don't think so. We're going to use it and it's going to be great, but I'm not concerned that humans aren't going to be involved anymore just because of the contextual nature of what it is that we do.
It kind of provides an assist, right? So like, the way I see it is in B2B selling, for example, yes, we're using AI to digitize sales and offer recommendations for quotes and bills of materials. However, the relationship that, you know, I, Miss Salesperson, can have with my customer now is far greater because I'm not sitting here sifting through pages of catalogs or speaking to different teams, having you on hold. I'm focused on my relationship with you. And that's the most important. I don't need to worry about the manual errors I'm going to make by building this quote on my own. So it's an assist role.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. It does make me wonder a little bit on the flip side, though, if the person doesn't have that subject matter expertise and they're relying on the assist from AI, do they lose a little bit of that, you know, authority that you have as a salesperson where you're like, this person knows exactly what washing machine I need because they, you know, they've sold 10 million of them.
Yeah.
Their grandma uses this one. And yeah. So there is like a little bit of a balance there, I think. Yeah. All right. So let's switch gears a little bit. You have a podcast as well. We're talking about that a little bit. Tell me about the podcast. What is the premise of it? I think you said you're number 50 over in Europe or the UK, rocking it up the charts. What is your podcast called and what's it about?
So podcast is called In Her Shoes, and In Her Shoes is about discovering the women behind the titles. So, over the last 15 years, I've built my career in tech, and the higher that I elevated, the less women that I saw. And my goal really was to have the conversations that, aren't being had outwardly or aren't being publicized and that aren't in magazines, real life conversations with women who are at the table, who've had to go through challenges to get to where they are. And the hope is that it serves as a blueprint to just empower and inspire the next generation of leaders to rise, because there was definitely some challenges and lessons learned along the way. And to be able to package that and give back is something that I think as I've developed in my career, it's something that has now become incredibly important to me. It's almost a bit more of purpose.
I love that. In Her Shoes.
Yes.
What's it called?
Okay. In Her Shoes.
Okay. Well, we'll link that in the show description notes. All right. I have one more question for you, non-business related. It's the mystery question. I still don't have a sounder for this. I need a sound to play when it's all right. So if you could do anything on earth and you knew you couldn't fail, what would it be?
That's a really good question. Let's sing.
It's my favorite. It's my favorite question. This pause is my favorite pause in the whole show. When people I actually have to come up with an answer.
Yeah, I think if I could do anything in the world, what would it be? God. I'd solve world peace. That's what I'd do.
There you go. I love it. I love it. That's fair, especially in today's world. Yeah. I think that's very topical. So, all right. If people want to find more about you, find your podcast, obviously, which we'll link in the show. If people want to reach out to you, how do they do that, Amise?
I mean, find us at zuvu.com. You can plug us for a demo there if you'd like to, if it's of interest, or me personally, LinkedIn. I'm very active over there, so come hit me up.
Beautiful. Well, you're a fantastic guest. You're doing some cool stuff, and I hope people reach out. And thank you so much for being on. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me.
See ya.